This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, making saving that little bit more exciting.
Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and with me today is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss and special guest, the undercover economist, Tim Harford. In last week's show, we explored in more detail his book and podcast, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy, but Tim also contributes to BBC Radio 4's More or Less podcast, which tries to make sense of the statistics that surround us. In an era of fake news, it's more important than ever to get the facts. Or is it? What do the numbers really measure? What kind of truth, if any, do they capture? And what is agnotology?
But we start with Boris Johnson. Do we have to, really? Mr. Johnson is wrong. But it seems that nothing will persuade him to stop these false claims. It doesn't seem to matter who fact-checks the number and who says it's wrong. The current and former chair of the UK Statistics Authority, they say it's wrong. Heaton Shah, the executive director of the Royal Statistical Society, he says it's wrong. The Institute for Fiscal Studies, they say it's wrong. The Office for Budget Responsibility has produced figures that show it's wrong, which means that the official position of the UK government seems to be that Boris Johnson is wrong.
Very warm welcome, Rachel. A very warm welcome, Tim. Firstly, Tim, why was Boris wrong? Go on, say it. I want to say for one last time, but I guarantee it will not be the last time you say this. Why was Boris and that figure of 350 wrong?
Because the 350 million a week figure did not include the rebate that Margaret Thatcher negotiated. So we do not send that amount of money to Brussels because Margaret Thatcher arranged for us to send less, in a nutshell. So what is more interesting to me is why I think I was wrong and other people like me were wrong to spend so much energy talking about that figure, because we've started to learn from the dynamic of the Trump election campaign, from the dynamic of the referendum campaign, that just relentlessly trying to hammer down untrue statistics does not necessarily inform people more. I think in the referendum campaign, for example, the fact that people just kept talking about the 350 million claim, saying it's not true, it's not true, it's not true, most people would draw from that, well, OK, maybe it's not true. But what we're basically talking about is we send a lot of money to Brussels, don't we? And it's true. The UK did send a lot of money to Brussels. And there was never a discussion about, was it worth it? Was that a reasonable amount of money to send? How much is that money relative to the national economy? What do we get for that? Is there a relationship worth exploring? What are the benefits and costs of EU membership? That entire discussion that I think would have been very helpful for people to really make an informed decision about what they wanted was basically drowned out by arguments over this particular statistic. And I spoke to one of the leading economists working on the Leave campaign. As you probably know, there aren't actually many economists working for the Leave campaign, but there were some. One of them, Andrew Lillicoe, very thoughtful guy. And during the referendum campaign, for an episode of More or Less, I was talking to him about this particular number, and he was like, he was obviously a bit uncomfortable. Yeah, I would have used a slightly lower number. I think a lower number is more defensible. And you know, he didn't come out and just say it's rubbish, but he clearly didn't really want to be spending his time justifying it. But then later, when I interviewed him afterwards for a feature I was working on, he said, "Yeah, politically." I'm paraphrasing, it's not a direct quote, but politically I was wrong. That number was a very effective number for the Leave campaign to use. And the fact that it wasn't true made it more effective. Well, he said that, you know, the Remainers. I mean, I was trying to be a neutral fact checker, but both the fact checkers and a lot of Remain campaigners just kept repeating this number over and over again. And so the number sticks and the debate gets stuck on that one particular issue, which is an important issue, but not the only issue to discuss.
But then who's to decide? Do you say, actually, do you know what, for this 350 figure, should we just drop it and let's just focus on the issue around it? Well, you can't. Surely you need to prove when stats are wrong.
It is a very difficult thing. It depends what position you're trying to achieve. Are you, for example, like Full Fact, which is a great website, in a position where you're basically just trying to evaluate factual claims that people make? if you're trying to evaluate factual claims that people make, you evaluate that claim, you say it's true, it's false, it's partly true, and you move on to the next factual claim. If you're a programme like BBC's More or Less, you're doing that, but you're also trying to give people more context and trying to remind them of what's important. And of course, if you were a Remainer, as a lot of the British political establishment were, then you need to think about what's effective and what's going to persuade people. And that's a different question altogether.
Wasn't traditionally, Rachel, that the role of the press to fact check?
I'd like to think that it was ever thus, but I'm not sure that there's ever been a time that people have said, I've read it in the newspaper, therefore, end of debate. But what I find so interesting about this number, I am a trustee of a charity called Economy, talking about the economy for everyone. And we often talk about how the economy is not a very emotive subject. And as far as charities go, there are other causes that people really can get more behind because perhaps, you know, it's something they've experienced in their own lives or they've lost a family member to something that they want to, you know, there's a charity that they can support or, you know, sad looking donkeys on telly, whatever it is. Economy is different. But I think that 350 million just shows that that's totally not the case. That economics can be and numbers can be so emotive that on both sides you had real anger and frustration and it really started to encapsulate so many different things that were not about the number and not even necessarily, I'm going to say rational, but that's not fair. But from one side, it was about us being ripped off by the EU and everything that was wrong there. And on the other side, it was the injustices of the whole debate and fake news and how we're being hoodwinked by politicians. And for a number to be that powerful, it just gets me so angry just thinking about it. And there aren't that many numbers that do that. And it really has made me think differently about the charity, actually, and the way it presents itself.
Yeah. So I think this gets to a very interesting topic that certain scientists have been thinking about for a while. So scientists who deal with tobacco and the health effects of tobacco, and scientists who deal with climate change, and scientists who deal with vaccines, have been seeing this for quite a long time. But the rest of us, and certainly economists like me, I think we've been slightly blindsided by it. And what I'm talking about is this, that there are certain issues that people think about culturally or almost tribally. And I'm not dismissing any particular group of people. I'm just like, there are certain things that, like, this is the kind of thing that people like me believe. Like, these are the kind of clothes that people like me wear. This is the kind of food that people like me eat. This is the kind of TV that people like me watch, the kind of newspapers that people like me read. And this is the kind of fact that people like me believe. And we just tend to think of, well, facts are either facts or they're not facts, they're lies. But actually, for a lot of people, these factual claims are part of an identity. And that can be a Leaver identity. It can be a Remainer identity. It can be a pro-vaccine, pro-scientific progress identity, or it can be a suspicious of big pharma identity. You know, it can be a China invented climate change to cripple American manufacturing kind of identity. Or, I mean, there are all kinds of different identities that people can have. When they start thinking about facts in that way, all kinds of psychological defense mechanisms come into play. And people get very, very good at just finding reasons to disbelieve what people are telling them. And you need to think about fact-checking in that environment in a very, very different way. And I think we've been very slow to cotton on to that. One central lesson is it's really important to try to keep facts out of that realm if we can. There are certain vaccines, for example, this has been well studied by a group at Yale University. There are certain vaccines that have become part of the political conversation in the United States. And if you believe that, you know, you should get your kids vaccinated with that particular vaccine, that vaccine is effective, blah, blah, blah. People believe that or not, depending on what political party they're in. It's become completely a matter of ideology. But then there are other vaccines, very similar vaccines, that are just like, oh, I just asked my doctor. My doctor tells me what vaccines to take or what vaccines to give my kids. And so it is possible that some of these facts just get sucked into the political debate, the tribalism, and others are completely separate. And those of us who are just interested in people being well informed and you know, believing things that are true and not believing things that are not true, we desperately need to keep facts out of that tribal arena. Because then once they're sucked in, it's really difficult to get them out again.
So if we have our unconscious bias, well, what can we do?
Well, yeah, I mean, to some extent, our brains work the way they work. and we are tribal. Mm. I mean, we're tribal creatures. We always have been. But there are things you can do. And I want to say, I don't want to sort of sit here like some Spock-like creature and go, well, this is highly illogical, Captain. And of course, Spock doesn't have that accent. I apologise to the late Leonard Nimoy. But I don't want to pretend to be this kind of completely super logical, rational creature that I'm able to determine facts, but ordinary mortals think about it in tribal ways. I'm as subject to it as anyone else. You know, there are certain facts that I want to believe, or that I firmly believe that these are terrible facts about the world that I must campaign to change, or these are true facts about the world that I must... And so what do I do about it? The first thing is I try to notice how I'm feeling when I see a factual claim in a newspaper or on my Facebook feed or in Twitter. Like, the first thing I notice is, like, there will be an emotional response quite often. I think, oh, that can't be true. Or like, oh, those people again stirring up trouble. Or, yes, this is great, I must tell everyone about this fascinating fact. And just to just sit with my emotion for a moment and go, okay, why is there an emotional response from this factual claim? And that may well warn me that I'm about to make a mistake.
I'm wondering how much social media has a part to play in all this, because if you're talking about how a fact makes you feel, well, it impacts on where that fact has come from. And yeah. If you're on Facebook and that's come from a good friend or a close family member, I imagine your feeling towards that fact and that stat is going to be very different to if it's come perhaps from a traditional newspaper, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a very important question. It's an interesting question. And I think we're still studying it. It's a very rapidly moving topic. So, for example, Facebook has become a much more important supplier of news, even in the last couple of years. And there's been this shift that is happening from a big screen on a desktop or a laptop to a small screen on a mobile phone. And we already know that people perceive that those facts, it's different. You're getting fewer cues about where the story came from. It's quicker, you're more distracted, it's all smaller. And actually, our cognition works differently. We are processing facts or factual claims in a different way. But, I mean, what can we say about social media? It's not straightforward. It's wrong just to make them the villain of the piece. If you think about somebody who says, right, I buy the Financial Times, and I read the Financial Times every day, or I buy the Daily Mail, and I read the Daily Mail every day. I mean, I work for the Financial Times. I think it's a wonderful newspaper. But any newspaper has a point of view. Mm. There is an editor. Even if we think we're trying to tell the truth about everything, there's a strong view about what sorts of stories we think are worth reporting, what sorts of stories are interesting. So a very strong view of the world comes if all you're doing is reading one newspaper. And of course, some newspapers have a particular, you know, a very strong political view. Social media can be more extreme than a tabloid newspaper in some ways, because you hang around with your friends and people who believe stuff like you. But in other ways, it's often less extreme, in that you'll see different things. If you hang around on Facebook, your friends will share stuff from the Mail, stuff from the Sun, stuff from the Guardian, stuff like they will, you know, you will, and stuff from some really, you know, out there fake news sites or extremist sites. On the left, on the right, you'll see a spread. So the evidence that we've got so far suggests it might push people a little bit further away from the centre, but they will also see a broader spectrum of views on social media than they would see if they just went to one news website or read one newspaper.
I think you're a little bit more optimistic about the algorithms than I am, because surely the things that you like and that you click on, Facebook then starts, and other social media outlets, of course, start to then work on the basis of the things that you're interested in, and then they'll put those in front of you.
Although we've got some pretty good data on that, and it looks like the algorithm is just kind of the icing on the cake. Like, the cake is, I follow my friends. Mm. I do not follow people who I disagree with, right? That's what's really driving it. And the same thing on Twitter. And Twitter doesn't really have a lot of algorithmic processing at all. And Twitter was highly polarized even before it introduced any algorithms. So yeah, the algorithms, even if you were trying to just to follow left and right wing, a complete spread, then the algorithm would start to favor, oh, you seem to be sharing maybe the left-wing stuff more. You're retweeting the left-wing stuff more. We'll show you more left-wing stuff. The algorithm does that. But actually, most people are never in that position in the first place. Most people are already seeing the kind of things they believe because of who they follow and who they're friends with.
I'm also curious about the impact that social media has on our need for speed. And what happens when people don't want to wait for the stats?
In the early hours of June the 14th, a fire engulfed Grenfell Tower, a residential tower block in West London. A large number of people died, and in the aftermath, many people expressed outrage that a tragedy like this one was able to happen in modern Britain. But some people were also frustrated at the numbers being reported by the police, and then the media, of how many people had died. At noon on June the 14th, 11 hours after the fire started, the Metropolitan Police could only confirm that there had been 6 fatalities, although everybody expected the death toll to rise. 5 hours later, the number of confirmed dead was 12. The following morning, it was 17. These updates came regularly from the Metropolitan Police and the media, BBC included, reported those numbers as we received them. But questions started to be asked. This was the singer Lily Allen talking to Channel 4's John Snow 2 days after the fire had started.
I've never in my entire life seen an event like this where the death count has been downplayed by the mainstream media. 17. I'm sorry, but I'm hearing from people that the figure is much closer to 150 and that many of those people are children.
In thanking you, I'm bound to say that the difficulty is that...
Those are off-the-record numbers that I've been given from policemen and from firemen.
I'm also aware of it. I actually said at the beginning of the programme that the death toll is likely to mount very considerably.
So why is that not coming out now? I don't understand.
The difficulty is that they have to identify bodies.
That was a clip from More or Less, and we were looking there, of course, at the Grenfell tragedy. This idea about social media and the need for speed, how worrying is it when you have situations like that, when people are sort of hearing rumours, making up stats about what is an unbelievably tragic and fast-moving situation involving people's lives?
Yeah, well, I think the citizens around Grenfell Tower, that community of people would... of course, what answers immediately, just as soon as possible. And yes, that of course there would be stories and there would be rumours and people would be discussing what they knew. So I wouldn't blame social media for that. And people were frustrated at how long it was taking. And one of the interesting things we were able to do on More or Less was to sit down with the Metropolitan Police and just say, look, it's been weeks and weeks, why don't we know? And the Metropolitan Police, it was a very moving interview actually, were able to say, look, there's been so much devastation in that tower. It's so slow. This is why it's taking the time. So we were able to give it that space. But yeah, just more generally, people want to know now about anything. They want to respond now. They retweet. They want instant information, of course. And in many ways, that's great to have quick information over the internet or via social media. Twitter will often tell me if there's some local thing, like something's on fire near my house. What is it? Like, go on Twitter, you'll find it pretty fast. Twitter will tell you. But at the same time, it means that things that aren't true can spread very quickly. And there's the possibility to systematically, either for political reasons or for espionage reasons, or just to try and make money and sell adverts, just put out fake stuff and see what happens. And with that, some of that stuff does spread very quickly.
Are you worried about this? Are you particularly concerned about this era of fake news? And is it worse now in this kind of post-Brexit Trump era that we're in? Or does it just feel a lot worse?
I'm not so worried about fake news yet. It was a very good study by 2 economists. It was a bit rough and ready because they put it together in a hurry, but they're good. They're solid researchers, Hunt Alcott and Matthew Jensko. They did some research after Trump was elected on the prevalence of fake news. And of course, the word fake news has changed what it means recently, thanks to Trump himself. But at the time, fake news was specifically, it was things like, oh, the Pope has endorsed Donald Trump. Like that some kid in a basement in Bosnia literally invents this story because it's eye-catching and because for some reason, no one else is reporting the stories because it's not true. Right? So because it's unique and eye-catching, it gets retweeted, it gets shared. He's selling ads. He makes money from the ads. And it doesn't take any... there's no reporting effort with fake news. You just make it up. So there was a business model of fake news. But when Hunt Alcott and Matthew Jensko looked at it, they found actually... people hadn't seen that much fake news. There were a few prominent stories, but mostly people were getting their news from the TV. And even on social media, most of the news was may have had a political slant or a bias, but it had a basis in fact. So my take on this is that I'm much more worried about politicians in positions of power systematically, the technical term for this is they're polluting the communication environment. So systematically, basically trying to spread distrust, trying to drag facts into this environment where, like, oh, this is the kind of fact that people like me believe, and that's the kind of fact that the other side believe. I'm more worried about that than fake news. I think fake news, these kind of made-up stories to sell ads, is a bit of a distraction. But when you have politicians in serious positions of power besmirching the statistical authorities, putting out things that aren't true, that's much more worrying to me.
I just want to ask you more generally, we've spoken about politics, but economics as well. Every time we turn on the TV or the radio or we open the paper, we are bombarded by targets, price rises, GDP figures, interest rates, inflation, stats, blah, 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 blah. Are we just too reliant on numbers and statistics? And should we instead, I read a book by Dr. Pippa Mulgrim about the signals of everyday life that we should be looking at when we look at sort of economic issues?
So I haven't read Pippa's book, although I know her work a little. My sense is that it is easy to have a lot of noise coming from these statistical reports in the news that don't tell us very much. It's not the way that I like to talk about economics. I mean, I've been writing about economics for 15 years now, and I've hardly ever written a story that is like, oh, inflation came out and it's 2.6%. Blah, blah. And it's not because those statistics aren't important. In the medium term, they're very important. They're very informative. They really help decision makers, the Bank of England, for example, understand what's happening in the economy. The Chancellor of the Exchequer gets to figure out how much tax is going to come in, how much he or she can spend. I say he or she. It's always been a he, but hopefully we'll get a female Chancellor of the Exchequer one day. I mean, these statistics are very, very important. But from the point of view of the ordinary citizen, what is really interesting about economics is the questions that pop into your head when you're just wandering around. You say, well, why are Tesco pricing stuff like that? Or why is that cafe charging me this much for that kind of hot chocolate and this much for that sort of coffee? I mean, this is where I started with my first book, The Undercover Economist, and my most recent book, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. Same thing. Everyday things around us that influence our lives, that shape the choices that we're able to make, like how our working lives look, the jobs that we can do, the things that we can afford, the things that we can't afford, inequality, all of these things. None of that you really learn about by looking at the GDP figures or the inflation figures. Those numbers are important, but they're not of everyday interest. And so I am always focusing elsewhere.
I'm wondering, Richard, if those sorts of figures all the time can actually turn people off thinking about money and finance and have a detrimental effect on their own personal financial issues.
It's tricky, I think, with things like the reporting of GDP, as you say, or inflation. It's easy to turn off when you hear that word or an acronym. There sometimes is something to be learnt from these numbers, and even if they're not important or they don't seem important to you, or they're more important than they should be, there are people making decisions based on them that will affect your life. It's good to keep up with how they're being interpreted and what they are. But I think you're right. As soon as you say GDP or inflation, it can create barriers. And so there's a lot to be done sort of, I think, on both sides, getting people who talk about these numbers and this kind of data to do it in a way that is accessible and not desperately dull. But then also, I think we all have a responsibility, since it affects everyone, and it, just for the sake of accountability for those who do talk about it or make decisions based on it, to work out what this nonsense is that everyone's talking about.
I don't want to keep you forever, but just a final point, because you did write the book Messy, which again I think looks in more psychological detail, can we say that? Psychological aspect,
yeah,
of
it's a book about psychology and creativity and
yeah exactly. But then we've had now I think it's 6, is it, behavioral economists / psychologists win the Nobel Prize for economics. Are we shifting in the right direction there, which can kind of make economics for everyone?
Yeah, I should say, strictly speaking, it's not a Nobel Prize. There'll be letters. It's the Nobel Memorial Prize in economics,
but
it's okay. I'm happy to call it a Nobel Prize. And yeah, it's been won by most famously Daniel Kahneman, who's a psychologist, and recently by Richard Thaler, who's a behavioural economist. And behavioural economics is a kind of a psychologically richer style of doing economics. So rather than sort of saying, well, we're going to really simplify the way we think about human behaviour, because that you know, that helps us build more complex models and understand how systems fit together. We say, no, we really need the human element to be important. If we're going to understand issues like, oh, are credit card companies predatory? Are they taking advantage of people? Really hard to answer that question unless you have a psychologically richer view of the way people make decisions. So I don't think that behavioural economics has all the answers by any means. I think there's lots and lots of great work being done in economics that's nothing to do with psychology. But personally, I find it fascinating. It's really fun to write about. And I think it's great that behavioural economists are being rewarded, both with enormous kind of book contracts and with professional recognition. I mean, Thaler has been at the top of the economics profession for a long time. He's quite good at playing the downtrodden, oh, no one pays any attention to behavioural economics. Mm-hmm. People have been paying attention to Thaler for a very long time, but rightly so, because he's a very smart guy.
Before I let you go, you can listen to the previous podcast to find out more about Tim's latest book, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. But just give us a little teaser, if you would.
Yeah, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy is a book about 50 different ideas, inventions that shaped the world around us. So some of them are thousands of years old, like the plough. Some of them are very recent, like public key cryptography or seller feedback mechanisms used on eBay and Uber. Some of them are very concrete, like concrete, and some of them are very abstract, like, for example, double entry bookkeeping. But there's all of these individual stories of creativity, of inventors producing really cool things. And the fun thing for me is to trace the unintended consequences, not just, oh, here's somebody who invented a thing, but here's all the amazing and sometimes alarming effects that that invention had.
It really is a fantastic book and a fantastic podcast as well. You can download that from iTunes. Thank you so much to Tim Harford. Thank you very much as well to personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast and, of course, Tim's, why not rate us all on iTunes and tell your friends and family.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.